weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Trent Ford, the Illinois State Climatologist at the Prairie Research Institute. And today, we're talking about nuclear energy.
On this show, we've talked about how increased carbon emissions into the atmosphere are driving more severe weather events like extreme heat and flooding. Therefore, reducing carbon emissions is a necessary step in transitioning to a more sustainable future.
And there are many tools available to help us reduce carbon emissions, one of which is carbon-free or low-carbon energy sources. They provide us the energy we need without emitting much carbon into the atmosphere, especially when compared to burning fossil fuels. Today, we're diving into nuclear energy, which is one type of low-carbon energy source.
50 to 80% of the electricity produced and used in Illinois comes from nuclear power plants. In fact, Illinois is the nation's largest producer of nuclear power-generated electricity.
We're in the midst of a nuclear renaissance right now, and that's because power demand is meaningfully rising for the first time in a few decades. And at the moment, we just don't have enough clean energy options.
Nuclear energy at a turning point, seeing momentum as power demand jumps from electrification and data centers.
Nuclear power and technology, or big tech getting involved in it. Nuclear power has sort of gotten back into the conversation.
We're going to be way ahead of AI, and we've got
to talk about nuclear energy, we are joined by Katie Huff, Associate Professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She also served as Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy in the U.S. Department of Energy from 2022 to 2024 under the Biden administration. Welcome, Katie. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Katie, what kind of research do you focus on with nuclear energy?
Yeah, I do modeling and simulation, so computational software development, to support research around the multi-scale, multi-physics of neutrons and thermal hydraulics inside reactors, as well as questions about recycling nuclear fuel on the scale of many hundreds of reactors.
And how did you first get interested in nuclear energy?
Oh, well, you know, I was really interested in physics as a high schooler. I read The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes, and I thought, wow, these folks are smart. It would be nice if we could apply that kind of technology to climate change. I really was taken in by the promise of solving our climate crisis.
Can you describe, just at a kind of a basic level, what is nuclear energy?
Yeah, like a lot of thermal energy sources, nuclear energy is just a very fancy way of boiling water and spinning a turbine to send some electrons through the grid. In a nuclear power plant, the source of that initial heat that boils the water is the fission of typically uranium isotopes. So some atoms tend to break apart, releasing some of their pent-up energy if you strike them with a neutron. They also release more neutrons, thus allowing for a chain reaction where one reaction leads to more reactions. If we can keep the number of reactions steady inside a device, you can keep the amount of power being created also steady.
And so can you talk a little bit more about how the reactor itself works? Can you give us a little bit of insight into how you might slow down a reaction?
Sure, yeah. So there are a number of different reactor designs. We're seeing more and more of them out in the sort of startup world. But in a conventional nuclear power plant, a solid uranium oxide, so ceramic fuel pellet about the size of the end of your pinky finger, holds some uranium isotopes, and it's in you stack a whole lot of these into a core. You cool it by water, and you allow fissions to happen. You remove the heat by flowing the water past at a high rate and exchanging the heat in the water with a heat exchanger and then sort of sending that off to the turbine. So how does that work inside? Well, you know, you have a number of control mechanisms, including some of the chemistry in the water. You can inject isotopes that tend to absorb neutrons, thus sort of dampening the reaction. You can drop physical control rods that also include isotopes that tend to absorb neutrons, thus, again, dampening the reaction. You raise those control rods to allow the reaction to bloom a little more. And that's how reactor control operators sort of tend to interact with the reactor. You can also do things like slow down or speed up the speed of that flow inside the reactor to change the power dynamics as well.
And what is the difference between, because so far you talk about fission reactors, I think you mentioned, what's the difference between that and fusion?
Such a good question. So in fission, we're breaking apart a really large nucleus. Typically uranium-235 nucleons are inside that nucleus. In fusion, you're typically fusing, putting together two very, very small isotopes. Their nuclei maybe have one or two or three nucleons, like neutrons and protons, and you try to, you know, either inertially slam them together so that they form a single nucleus, thus releasing some energy, interestingly, or you sort of magnetically press them together. And so those two options are just different kinds of fusion, but nuclear fusion is, you know, it's had a lot of exciting scientific breakthroughs recently, but, you know, there are a lot of engineering challenges before we get to a real commercial plant. A number of folks here on campus are working on that, but nuclear fission is the kind of nuclear energy that supports about 20% of our electric grid today here in the United States.
And so how much energy are we talking from one of these fission reactors?
Yeah. A standard conventional reactor is about a gigawatt, so 1,000 megawatts. And there are 94 of them operating here in the United States right now, and they together make up about 18 to 20% of our total electric consumption.
What are some of the benefits of nuclear energy when compared to some other carbon-free sources?
Sure. I think the main benefit is reliability and kind of consistency, right? Nuclear reactors can be always on. They're weather independent. You do have to shut them down periodically to refuel, but not very often, maybe once every year and a half, 2 years, only for about a month. And you can time that nicely with dips in demand, like in the spring and the fall. This is distinct, of course, from variable nuclear energy that you get from the sun, right? The sun is really a fusion reactor. So solar power, right? It has to vary with regard to whether the sun's out, whether there are clouds, same with wind, right? Whereas nuclear fission reactors typically just keep going and going. There's not a lot of unexpected shutdowns at nuclear power plants.
And you mentioned the water that's needed to cool oftentimes. How much water does a nuclear reactor need, at least one of those at a larger scale like you talked about?
It is comparable to the amount that a coal plant needs. It is a bit more than a natural gas plant would need. And of course, solar and wind don't tend to need any. Something important to keep in mind is the amount that gets pulled from an ultimate heat sink. The vast majority gets returned to that ultimate heat sink. So not a lot of it is actually consumed in the nuclear reactor, but quite a lot of it is sort of pulled in and spat out every day by a standard nuclear reactor that has an ultimate heat sink that's like a lake or a river or an ocean or something like that. So in terms of numbers, I think we're talking about total use in the 700 million gallons per day range for the whole nuclear fleet in the U.S. But that's pretty comparable to the kind of coal plant. You know, per megawatt hour, nuclear is pretty similar to coal plants, but natural gas is a little more efficient.
So Trent, kind of thinking about Illinois specifically, how much nuclear energy do we use in Illinois?
Yeah, so this I had to look all these different things up because, but I knew it was a lot, but I didn't know how much of a lot it was. So Illinois' nuclear reactors produced about 100 million megawatt hours of energy in 2023, which is the last year we have like the numbers for right now, which is a little over half, 53% of the state's electricity net generation. I feel Katie looking at me. In case I mess up one of these numbers, you're going to have to correct me. But 53% of the state's electricity net generation. So it's the largest single source of electricity for Illinois. And it's also the 100 million megawatts that we produced in 2023 in Illinois was the most nuclear power generated by any state. And in fact, Illinois produces 1/8 of all the nuclear energy produced in the entire United States. We're very nuclear dependent, nuclear progressive, whatever you want to call it. I will say, though, also that Illinois, especially when it comes to nuclear production, is a generator. So not as much of a consumer. I mean, it certainly consumes, but the generator, meaning that about 1/5 of all the electricity generated in Illinois is sent to other states, which is the third most of any state sort of exporting energy. So it's not just, you know, fuel for internal consumption in Illinois, but also production for other states around us.
And Katie, is there a reason why we're such a leader in nuclear power generation?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of ways you could talk through this, but I think it comes down to history. The very first fission chain reaction controlled by humans happened right here in Illinois at the University of Chicago. Enrico Fermi led it as part of the Manhattan Project. We controlled nuclear fission as humans for the first time here in this state. And then, you know, that research, of course, went on to help with the Manhattan Project, but also to support peaceful understanding, peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And Commonwealth Edison put, you know, the Dresden 1 plant together, which was one of the first, I think it was the first privately owned nuclear power plant that produced commercial power in the country. And so we have Dresden 1, the first sort of commercial plant, and we have the very first controlled, human-controlled fission chain reaction right here in Illinois. Of course, you know, nuclear energy also relies pretty heavily on a union workforce that can build nuclear power plants, electricians and boilermakers and welders. And a lot of that workforce is really present in Illinois and has been historically. So that's helped us build reactors here.
You're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about climate and weather. We're talking about nuclear energy in Illinois and how it's a carbon-free source of electricity. We are joined by Katie Huff, Associate Professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And Trent, just to give us some more perspective on Illinois nuclear power, how many reactors do we have here in Illinois?
Yeah, so among six current power plants, there's a total of 11 reactors. All of the six power plants are, most of them are actually in northern Illinois. The one that's closest to us is Clinton Power Plant, which is owned by Constellation. It's the closest here to Champaign-Urbana.
So kind of thinking about the economics of all of this, because that is, you know, pretty big driver as we transition to more of a renewable energy economy. So Katie, can you give us a perspective of how the price of nuclear energy compares to other carbon-free energy sources?
Yeah, I mean, in a per megawatt hour basis, it is more expensive, right? But I think there's a critical component here where if you compare energy system to energy system, if you have to back up solar or wind with battery power or other grid scale storage, you start to get into very comparable numbers. And so actually in the Biden administration, we released a number of liftoff reports to talk about sort of what it would take to get to commercial liftoff for new technologies in the clean energy space. It included stuff around hydrogen and grid scale storage and batteries and also nuclear. And some of those systems analyses indicated that sort of new nuclear was going to be comparable to other energy systems that included clean energy that got us to our zero carbon goals, because a lot of those include some technologies that require some development as well and can be very expensive, like especially storage.
Are there government subsidies for using nuclear in Illinois, either state or federal level?
The CEJA gave some tax credits to help ensure that nuclear power stayed open here in the state of Illinois. Federally, there's also production tax credits for a lot of clean energy that were passed in the Inflation Reduction Act. Some of those were specific to nuclear. Some of those were more general. Some of those have not stuck around or may not stick around, and I think are under discussion. But generally speaking, nuclear qualifies in many states for some of those clean energy tax credits, including Illinois.
And are some of those, so kind of thinking about constructing a nuclear reactor, there's so much upfront cost as maybe much more than opposed to like solar or wind. Do some of these subsidies kind of target that specifically?
Yeah, such a great question. I think some of the most important like federal support for nuclear energy is in the Loan Programs Office, which allows low-cost capital to be borrowed by someone who wants to build a really big plant. And you're right, the capital cost of nuclear is where all the money really goes. The first, you know, 10 years before you've actually turned on the reactor, you've spent almost all the money you really are ever going to need to spend. The fuel and the workforce certainly weigh in over the long lifetime of that reactor, but the vast majority of the cost is in constructing it. And so low-cost capital is the name of the game in actually getting nuclear power built.
So you touched on us safely storing nuclear waste before. Can you talk about a little bit more about what is nuclear waste and how do we store it safely?
Yeah, absolutely. Nuclear spent fuel is, first of all, a solid. It's not a green glowing goo that you might have seen on The Simpsons. And I kind of green glowing goo image is false. There's basically those small ceramic pellets that went into the reactor come back out as small ceramic pellets. But instead of uranium, a fraction of those uranium atoms have turned into more radioactive parts of atoms, which are now other isotopes, other nuclides, that are more radioactive than when they went in. And so that spent nuclear fuel has to be managed very carefully. But our process is such that you take the fuel out of the reactor, you allow it to cool in a cooling pool for a few years, then you take it out, you dry it. Again, it's in these long rods. And you put it inside a steel and concrete canister, and right now it is waiting in a number of steel and concrete canisters in dry storage for its ultimate final disposal. And that's mostly a policy question of how we can identify an appropriate location for a final repository. But the utilities have actually already paid into the fund that will support that repository. And in fact, the ratepayers through the utilities paid for that. About a mil, so a small fraction of a cent per kilowatt hour, was paid to support the building of that repository. And a $40-ish billion fund sits waiting to spend. So it's kind of already been paid for.
And give maybe, and I'm not sure if you know this or not, but give some idea of scale for the decades that we've been generating nuclear power, nuclear waste. How much physically, how much space does the waste that we've currently generated take up?
It would fit even in the packaging, so those big steel and concrete canisters inside of a super Walmart.
Yeah, I've heard something like that before, and that really surprised me because I imagine mountains of nuclear waste, but we are talking about a department store worth of it and over 60 years?
That's correct.
Wow, yeah. That's incredible.
It's a very large number of metric tons, right? It's over 90,000 metric tons, but uranium is quite compact. A metric ton, you could sort of hug. I wouldn't recommend it. And ultimately, that incredible energy density means that the spent fuel, that very high-level waste that we have to manage for a very long time, is pretty dense and small.
So, you know, some listeners at home may be uncomfortable. It's interesting, the idea of nuclear reactors, especially those that either grew up around the different incidents that happened at Chernobyl and then at Three Mile and, of course, Fukushima more recently.
This is the news station, WNEP 16.
To bring you up to the minute, an unexpected release of more radiation today from the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant has led to a series of consequences.
But at a news conference early this afternoon, Governor Thornburg suggested pregnant women and preschool children within a five-mile radius of Three Mile Island leave the area.
It was the first step in a nuclear nightmare. As far as we know, at this hour, no worse than that. But a government official said that a breakdown in an atomic power plant in Pennsylvania today is probably the worst nuclear reactor accident to date.
This is ABC News Nightline. Reporting
for the first time ever, the Soviet Union admits it has had a nuclear accident, and it's clearly a major one.
It's almost certainly the most severe accident that has ever taken place in the short history of civilian nuclear power.
Massive quantities of radiation have apparently been released in an accident at the Chernobyl power station in the Ukraine. Many thousands of people live in the vicinity. Moscow.
So how do you, I'm sure you communicate like this before with folks who may be a little bit uncomfortable with the idea of nuclear power, nuclear waste. What would you say to those folks to kind of assuage some of their concerns, specifically around like safety technology to reduce the chances of things like meltdowns?
Yeah, I would say there's sort of two things to really think hard about. One is that we learned a lot from Three Mile Island here in the United States. We made real changes to emergency planning after Fukushima, and we don't have reactors similar to those that caused Chernobyl, the RBMK, and we have very serious containment structures and planning that allow for the worst consequences of a nuclear accident in the United States to be quite minimal to the public. So that's one thing. And then the second is, even with that incredible level of safety, which frankly is very high, one of the safest energy sources available in terms of, for example, deaths per terawatt hour, even with that incredible record of safety, we are developing even more safe reactors. So one of my favorite technologies that's coming online now are tristructural isotropic fuels, which sounds very fancy, but is just to say very well-coated uranium. Little teeny tiny particles about the size of a chia seed coated in some of the hardest materials known to man with very high melting points so that in the very worst accident, the fission products, those radioactive half particles, are contained. And that is extremely promising for allowing those reactors to operate and with confidence that there will be very limited consequences even to the worst conceivable accident.
And is this the type of fuel that is going to be used in the Illinois microreactor?
Yeah, so the nano MMR is a TRISO-fueled reactor, and so it would leverage that technology if it were built here at Illinois.
And this is completely off the cuff here, but two-part question, one with a follow-up. Have you seen the movie Atomic Twister?
No.
Okay. That's something we can discuss offline. Mark Paul Gosselaar is a nuclear engineer or something at a power plant in Tennessee, and there's going to be a big F5 tornado, and for hours worth of the movie, he goes back and forth between home and his power plant. And anyway, it brings up the thought about we don't have the tsunami, you know, generated by earthquake potential here in Illinois that Fukushima does, but we do get quite a bit of tornadoes. I mean, are power plants that are currently operating, are they built for, let's say, like a direct strike to a tornado in a Mark Paul Gosselaar movie?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite nuclear facts is actually that those containment structures that contain the nuclear reactor have been tested out at Sandia National Laboratory against the question of a direct impact from a jet. So they can go pretty well beyond tornadoes in terms of containing that reactor. Now, the switchyards, for example, are just as susceptible to damage as any other switchyard unless they're contained inside a building. And so you actually do see scenarios in which repairs are required at any nuclear power plant or non-nuclear power plant to the switchyard. But the reactor itself is contained by one of the strongest structures known to man.
Yeah.
You're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about climate and weather. We're talking about nuclear energy in Illinois and how it's a carbon-free source of electricity. We are joined by Katie Huff, Associate Professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So kind of thinking about a lot of the stuff that we've talked about today kind of come back to the theme of trust with the public and science communication. Sort of from your end, if we want to think about, you know, transitioning to, you know, more renewables, more carbon-free energy, is kind of the challenge with getting the U.S. more on board with nuclear energy on the science communication side or on the engineering and scientific side?
Yeah, right now, public sentiment about new nuclear is growing by leaps and bounds. Pew Research study has indicated that 59% of Americans want more nuclear power. This is up by a significant margin since 2020, and it really comes down to interest in seeing carbon-free technologies deployed on the grid and a recognition that nuclear is going to be necessary if we want a reliable grid. And so I think public sentiment is going fairly well in terms of both safety and environmental concerns. And in fact, environmental concerns are driving some of the interest in nuclear. The thing that I think does come in the way is more economics, right? It is expensive. It can take a long time to build. There are sort of serious questions about how you can acquire enough sort of low-cost capital to build these plants. And so when the rubber meets the road, I think it's less about public sentiment, which is, I think, growing really positively. It's very bipartisan. The split between Republicans and Democrats in terms of that Pew Research study was interestingly like much closer than under other energy sources. The parties are much more split on other energy sources than nuclear. They're much more aligned on nuclear. But it does come down, I think, mostly to cost, which is finite. And we have to worry about folks, you know, pocketbooks.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like with kind of nuclear and carbon kind of have sort of the opposite problem. Like nuclear, all of the cost is up front. But with carbon as a risky asset, we're going to see some of those costs much later down the line.
Yeah. And as fossil fuels are also somewhat unreliable in the context of international conflict and things of this nature, we do have to be careful about the reliability of some of those as well.
And so I want to briefly touch back on one thing you said about nuclear being very important for a reliable grid as we transition to carbon-free energy sources. Can you just clarify or expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is room inside a sustainable net zero grid for all of the clean energy sources we can possibly build. And I think the niche that nuclear plays is replacing some of the baseload, high capacity like generation that coal plants currently satisfy. As we retire coal plants, there's a natural place on the grid for a few hundred megawatts per plant to provide constant, always on 100% power. And you could sort of one-to-one replace those coal plants with nuclear. It's harder to sort of one-to-one replace those coal plants with renewables as they need to be sort of backed up by something like natural gas or storage. If we want to get away from carbon completely, then it needs to be storage or natural gas with carbon capture. And so nuclear is a great choice for just one-to-one replacing those coal plants. And I think that's the niche that it fits in. I especially get excited about the fact that those coal plants are run by people that are very similar to the folks that run nuclear power plants, right? The turbine operators and machinists and electricians that help to make sure a coal fossil plant is running well are the very same skill sets that are needed mostly to run a nuclear power plant. There are only a few nuclear reactor operators in the control room. Pretty much everyone else is worried about hot steam and electrons.
Yeah, that is exciting, that sort of green job transition.
Yeah, my wife's uncles are boilermakers down in the St. Louis area, and they've worked on both, right? They can still get contracted through a union to do coal and then nuclear for some work later on. So it's neat that way, that adaptable position.
Recently, NASA has become extremely interested in what it takes to have a more sustained presence on the moon. And we've had a fission surface power program in the United States for the last few years, looking at what it looks like to have a nuclear reactor stationed on the moon. The current administration has proposed a much accelerated timeline and an increased size for that reactor, which will be an engineering challenge. But I think it is important for folks to know that there are reactors right now orbiting Earth in space.
There are nuclear reactors orbiting space?
There are fission reactors, mostly generated, in fact, all of them, except for one attempt, were USSR and Russian deployments, and they power satellites that orbit the Earth. And they are no longer, most of them, operating, but many of them operated for a few years, and their final resting place is just slightly higher in orbit than the places where they were powering satellites. So there have been a few dozen nuclear reactors powering satellites as they orbit the Earth.
That's really neat. Yeah. And we also have dozens of nuclear reactors under the ocean, right, as we speak, too, right?
That's right. The nuclear submarines that, you know, prowl the seas, as well as, of course, on the surface of the ocean, aircraft carriers are powered by nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
So, Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Katie is an associate professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She also served as Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy in the U.S. Department of Energy under the Biden administration. For those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover.
And I'm Trent Ford.
Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Coming up next, we're talking about a micronuclear reactor that is scheduled to be built right here in Urbana-Champaign.